prayers, obstructing the lives of Al-Quds residents, including their prayers, without any freedom. Palestinian Christians have not only canceled holiday celebrations, but have also in recent weeks sent letters to all religious and human rights authorities worldwide, urging them to work to stop the genocide against Gaza. At the same time, condemnations continue for the visit by the heads of Christian churches in Al-Quds to the residence of Israeli entity President Isaac Herzog during the holiday season. Among the condemnations was a statement from the Pastoral Council of the Ramallah Roman Catholic Melkite Church, which denounced the meeting, saying, "Such meetings do not represent us and are not related to us." Targeting Christians in Gaza as well as in the West Bank or occupied Al-Quds did not begin with the start of the aggression, but extends back before that. Reference is made here to the attacks suffered by Christian clergy in early October prior to the Al-Aqsa flood battle from assaults by settler groups in Al-Quds involving physical violence and spitting, in addition to attacks by occupation police forces. Commenting on this incident at the time, the World Council of Churches in Al-Quds stated that Christians are facing persecution from Zionist Israeli extremist groups, criticizing the Israeli entity government's silence on the matter and adding, "We feel persecuted as Christians and for Christianity as a religion in the country. There is Israeli Jewish persecution that is encouraged either through police negligence or through the statements made by Israeli government ministers." Now, the harassment is not limited to determining the numbers of worshippers and the paths they take in Al-Quds. It extends to the collaboration of the occupation police with settlers and Zionist right-wing extremist groups who roam the neighborhoods and alleys of the city. Christian believers are subjected to insults and verbal abuse. On many occasions, the occupation police intervene and physically assault them in case of disputes with settlers who regularly spit at Christian believers wherever they see them. Now, Minister of National Security Itamar Ben-Gvir defended those acts, saying, "There is an ancient Jewish custom to spit when passing near a monastery or priest, and you can agree with it or disagree." Ben-Gvir then questioned, "Why do we turn spitting on Christians into a criminal offense?" "I know, it angers me too. Spit back on the occupation and only then Christmas will be merry again." Welcome to the Middle East Stream, Amar Osman. In a show of solidarity with the Palestinians of Gaza and the devastation there, church leaders in Bethlehem and elsewhere in the Palestinian Holy Land have asked local Christians to avoid public displays of celebration and to instead intensify their prayers for the war's innocent victims. Bethlehem municipal authorities, too, announced the removal of previously installed Christmas decorations in solidarity with our people in Gaza. To discuss this issue with us from Damascus, Syria, is Father Elias Zahlawi, a Catholic priest of the Church of Our Lady of Damascus. Father Zahlawi, it's an honor to have you with us, especially on these very tough, devastating days with Christmas being on the verge of these very devastating days. Now, as you know, there is no Christmas in Bethlehem this year. Actually, there's no Christmas in all of Palestine, all of the region of West Asia. With the U.S. Zionist Israeli war on the Gaza Strip, festivities are off. This year, there will be no Christmas in the city that is synonymous with the birth of Jesus Christ, peace be upon him, because of the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Now, as a man of the church yourself, what does this cancellation mean to you and to your parish?
I wonder, what is the significance of celebrating the birth of Christ, who brought to the world the most profound meanings of God and humanity? I question what this celebration has turned into. Regardless of religious observances, the current events have no connection to the birth of the one who carried the perfect image of God and humanity. Whether they observe religious festivities or not, what is happening today, starting from Palestine and extending worldwide, is unlike what Christ intended with his birth in Bethlehem. He came glorifying God. But what unfolds today from Palestine across the globe reminds us of Herod's actions after the birth of Jesus Christ, where he slaughtered children in Bethlehem in an attempt to eliminate the newborn Jesus. Today's events, heard and seen globally, including by all churches, notably the Vatican, are unimaginable and unacceptable to both God and humanity. Whether celebrated or not, Jesus Christ has no association with this holiday or its celebrations. That's my perspective.
Father Zahlawi, knowing that churches were not spared in the Zionist Israeli attack on Gaza, where Christians who were displaced civilians who found refuge in the churches of Gaza, were targeted and they were martyred inside of their churches, what do you think priests this Christmas should do or should say to their pastoral activities, to their parish, to urge them to stand strong, maybe to support those that are facing the war in the Gaza Strip and also in the occupied West Bank, because we have been seeing this kind of discrimination against especially the Christian believers as well as the Muslim ones in Al-Quds city as well?
What is required from those representing Christ, regardless of their rank in the church, whether an ordinary being, a bishop, a patriarch, a cardinal, or the Pope in Rome, is to speak as Jesus did out of love for humanity and in reverence to God. All denominations have remained silent today, especially the Western churches. While it's true that the Al-Aqsa flood began on the 7th of October, and the Pope spoke on the 16th of December following the killing of two Christian women in a Gaza church, I would like to ask the Pope and all Western churches, are these two women the only ones worthy of concern among the human category, while thousands of children, women and men were martyred in Gaza? Why did His Holiness the Pope speak only after the assassination of two Christian women in Gaza? And neither he nor any bishop in the West or East spoke out about the killing of tens of thousands of children and women. Why this silence? I wonder, and openly pose the question awaiting an answer.
Father Zahrawi, we saw that heads of Christian churches in Al-Quds visited last week the residence of the Israeli entity president, Isaac Herzog, and they even took public photographs with the man while the Christians of Gaza were being killed under the rubble of their own churches because of the Israeli Zionist bombings. And the Christians of Al-Quds are being harassed. They are being even spat on by the occupation soldiers and settlers. What message would you send to those heads of Christian churches after their visit to the head of the Zionist entity?
When I read the news about the meeting of leaders from different Christian denominations in Al-Quds with the head of the Zionist entity, I felt deep sorrow. However, I found some consolation when I learned that a priest from the Catholic Church in Ramallah protested against the project of the Christian leaders meeting with the head of the Zionist entity. But I truly wonder about this silence. Churchmen are not required to carry weapons. They are required to uphold the words of Jesus. Jesus' words are a defense of God, for God is love and justice, defending every human being, especially in the land of the Christ. What has been happening there for 75 years is a complete denial of all that Jesus Christ carried for humanity, light, love, dignity, and peace. I don't ask churchmen to bear arms. I only ask them to say what Jesus said. Jesus did not carry a weapon. He carried words, and His words changed the world. Today, why do we submit in the name of money and power to authorities that destroy the values of God and human values? It's time for us to wake up and trust that everything happening in Gaza today will be the beginning of a change globally, as change has already started at the grassroots level. As for governments, unfortunately, even some Arab governments have become entangled with Zionism. However, the people have risen. We have even heard officials in America say that what is happening in Gaza liberated us in America. I believe we are facing the birth of a new world.
Father Zahlawi, in less than 1 minute, what could you say, what is your message to the people of Gaza at these very difficult times on Christmas Day?
Being in the Church of Our Lady in Damascus, I remember only this. 2,000 years ago, someone came to Damascus carrying an absolute hostility towards Christianity. In Damascus, Christ appeared to him, transformed his heart, and he became the greatest evangelist known to Christianity. That was the fate of Saul, who became Saint Paul. Today, I hope that from Gaza, a new light will emerge, a new direction for a new world. I earnestly hope for it from the bottom of my heart. And I ask the Allah, the God of the heavens and the earth, to bestow His grace upon all humans, even upon the oppressors, restoring their dignity as human beings, bringing them peace and love as humans. May humanity experience a period of safety, joy, and tranquility, at the least for a while. Peace be with you.
Father Zahlawi, thank you very, very much on this very special day for being with us from Syria, from Damascus. Father Elias Zahlawi, a Catholic priest of the Church of Our Lady of Damascus, Merry Christmas to you and to all your parish and to all the Christians, especially the Christians of West Asia, who have been suffering under the occupation in the occupied Holy Lands of Palestine. Thank you very much for being with us and for giving us a bit of your time on Christmas Day. Ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how the Iraqi resistance is supporting our brothers and sisters in Gaza.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
October 17, 2023, Iraqi resistance factions have been actively involved in the latest conflicts that broke out in West Asia on October 7, known as Al-Aqsa Flood Operation. As part of their role in the axis of resistance, these Iraqi factions targeted U.S. occupation military bases in Syria and Iraq with about 110 attacks, using bomber drones, Grad and Katyusha missiles, all the way to threatening to use precise long and medium-range missiles. More details in the following report.
The Islamic resistance in Iraq threatened to escalate attacks with drones and missiles against U.S. occupation bases in Iraq and Syria, with the continuation of the U.S.-covered Israeli entity aggression on the Gaza Strip, a possibility for which Washington says has prepared for by strengthening its missile systems deployed in the region. Meanwhile, the Islamic resistance in Iraq announced at dawn on Friday, December 22, that it had managed to strike a target in the Zionist illegal settlement of Eilat. The resistance said in a statement, "In continuation of our approach to resisting the occupation in support of our people in Gaza and in response to the massacres committed by the usurping entity against Palestinian civilians, including children, women, and the elderly, the Mujahideen of the Islamic resistance in Iraq targeted the occupied Umm al-Rashrash area with appropriate weapons." This came less than 24 hours after threats made by Zionist Israeli War Minister Yoav Gallant, who declared on Wednesday that Israel will respond to any attack targeting the southern city of Eilat, whether with missiles or other means. Meanwhile, the Israeli entity military spokesman announced the destruction of a drone that was targeting Zionist Israeli sites across the sea a few days ago, while the Islamic resistance in Iraq said that it targeted an Israeli entity gas field platform in the Mediterranean. A source in the Islamic resistance in Iraq explained that the vital site that was targeted in the Mediterranean Sea was the Karish gas field platform, stressing that the attack was successful. The resistance then explained that it shall continue to bomb the strongholds of what it described as the enemy in response to the massacres committed by the Israeli occupation in Gaza against Palestinian civilians. It is noteworthy that Iraqi factions, most notably the Islamic Resistance in Iraq, has launched hundreds of attacks on U.S. occupation bases in Iraq and Syria, in conjunction with the war launched by Zionist Israel against the Gaza Strip, which has so far led to the martyrdom of about 20,000 civilians, most of them women and children, and more than 50,000 were injured. U.S. officials did acknowledge that these attacks have occurred, but said that the U.S. Army forces in Syria and Iraq responded to most of them, in addition to directing strikes in Iraq and Syria against sites the Pentagon claimed were linked to Iran. In the meantime, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq threatened the U.S. occupation that its bases in both Syria and Iraq are a legitimate target for it, due to the main role of the United States of America in the war on the Gaza Strip.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hamza Khansa, journalist and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Hamza, on this very early morning. Now, the Iraqi resistance factions have been enhancing their missile capabilities and their expertise in the field of drones in an attempt to position themselves for a major battle in the region. Now, the Al-Aqsa flood operation on October 7th and the Israeli entity war on the Gaza Strip, it imposed the first of its kind test for these factions, which are part of the Axis of Resistance, as they decided to enter alongside Hezbollah and other resistance factions to support Gaza with their best ability. What has their involvement in this war so far brought forth for this regional confrontation?
Today, the resistance factions in Iraq are working vigorously to demonstrate to everyone that they are an integral part of the Axis of Resistance. Regarding the Operation Al-Aqsa flood and the subsequent Israeli entity aggression on Gaza, these factions have proven themselves not only as an inseparable part of this axis, but also as an active participant. They carry out almost daily operations not only within Iraq, but also against U.S. occupation bases in Syria, underscoring the significance in supporting the Palestinian resistance. The geopolitical importance of Iraq, its presence of U.S. forces and security agreements contribute to making the Iraqi front strategically crucial. The internal political complexities in Iraq amplify this importance, making it a vital and strategic front, especially considering the capabilities and ongoing development of the Iraqi resistance. All Iraqi resistance factions have threatened to enhance their support front, entering a new phase of confrontation. Today, Iraqi actions from its geographical position hold multifaceted significance, pressuring the United States centrally and fundamentally, which is why the U.S. prioritizes preventing the Zionist occupation from triggering a regional war, acknowledging Iraq's potential role in such a conflict. And we are all aware of the substantial U.S. presence and interests in Iraq and Syria.
Well, Mr. Hamza, the noteworthy part, and taken from what you just said, is that why is the U.S. occupation so far sticking to this strategy, knowing that the Iraqi resistance, as you just explained, they announced that they will expand their range of targets along for both inside of U.S. military occupation bases in the region and Zionist Israeli territories in Palestine as well.
Let's imagine the scene today in the ongoing aggression in Gaza, without supportive fronts from Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. The Israeli and American reactions would undoubtedly be extremely harsh, possibly forming alliances to launch a broader ground invasion of Gaza with multinational forces. The supportive fronts, including the main front in Iraq, played a role in limiting the U.S. response. For instance, in Yemen, there are attempts to form alliances to combat the Yemeni resistance, but American naval assets in the Red Sea and adjacent maritime regions remain inactive. Similarly, in Iraq, the U.S. acknowledges that Iraqi resistance not only possesses capabilities, but also the will and determination to expand the front and target American forces and interests.
But you know, there's something very critical in what's going on in Iraq, because over the years we've seen that after the Iraqi resistance victory over Daesh and the Iraqi resistance factions operated in very politically complex situations and security environments, We have the presence of direct U.S. military occupation in Iraq. We have an Iraqi government that was at some times hostile towards the resistance like that of former Prime Minister Mustafa al-Qadhimi. We had severe internal political division and negative external intervention, particularly from regimes in the Arabian Peninsula. Do you think any of these challenges might hinder the efforts of the Iraqi resistance in supporting our people in Gaza?
Since the United States entered Iraq as an occupying force, it has attempted to fabricate numerous issues and obstacles to benefit from in situations like today, aiming to prevent the formation of resistance forces or political currents in Iraq sympathetic to the region's causes. The U.S. has worked to fuel sectarianism, support ISIS, Daesh, and aid extremist Takfiri factions with the assistance of neighboring Arab countries, notably Saudi Arabia. Today, it continues to manipulate internal Iraqi politics, fostering animosity towards any resistance movement or those addressing the nation's concerns. The reality, Iraq has been a tool for the United States. But the Al-Aqsa flood and the courageous initiative of the resistance factions to open a supportive front from Iraq to Gaza surpassed all these American obstacles. It proved that the added willpower to the capabilities possessed by the resistance factions, coupled with sovereign and political decisions by their leaders, leapfrogs all these impediments. This becomes a strength for the resistance factions and a point against the U.S. presence in Iraq, which repeatedly tried to turn the country into a hub for conspiracies against the nation's causes under various religious and sectarian titles. Today, the strategic importance of the supporting front in Iraq lies in solidifying Iraq as a resistant country, with factions that decisively make strategic decisions, such as opening a supportive front for the Palestinian people. From another perspective, this significant decision by the resistance factions asserts that Iraq will not abandon the nation's causes, whether it's aggression against our people in Gaza, Lebanon, or eventually facing the American occupation in Syria. This is particularly relevant considering the issue of the American occupation within Iraq itself, as these factions have opened the file of liberating Iraq from American presence and resisting political, military, and economic pressures from the U.S. This truly concerns the American administration, who fears its repercussions in the later stages of the ongoing confrontation.
This is definitely what the United States of America is concerned about, the Iraqi factions and the Iraqi resistance in basically just eliminating the occupation from Iraq. I want to thank you very much from Beirut, Mr. Hamza Khansa, journalist at Al-Akhbar Daily and political commentator, for joining us to discuss the role of the Iraqi resistance factions in supporting our brothers and sisters in Gaza who are under a genocide as the people celebrates, sadly, this year's Christmas. Thank you for being with us, ladies and gents. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asle zinda ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned. Halal income reaches us through Prophet Muhammad and the Ahlul Bayt. Allah is all provider and the main sustainer. He is a Razzaq. Now, one of the main blessings of Allah is His sustenance for people. Allah is the main source of all blessings, and He has many divine manifestations on earth, including power, dignity, and honor.
اون کمال بصیر بودن خدا به ما خورده که ما بصیریم میتونیم ببینیم.
Allah is al-basir, meaning all-seeing. Since Allah is all-seeing, we can see too. Allah is omnipotent and we can have power too. This means that all the creatures of Allah on earth benefit from Him, namely Allah. If we earn halal income and we use it in our halal sustenance, we are in fact reaching back to Allah. In other words, our halal income makes us perfect and our sustenance perfect in the eyes of Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.ir Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Islamic Human Rights Commission has launched a massive campaign seeking a boycott of those governments and companies that support Israel's genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Middle East Eye has covered this story and tells us more. Four British arms factories supplying components for the F-35 stealth fighter jets used by Israel to bomb the Gaza Strip have been temporarily shut down by hundreds of workers and demonstrators protesting against Israel's genocidal war in Gaza. Footage posted online on Thursday, 7th of December, showed activists blocking the entrances into the factories. The factories are Eaton Mission Systems in Bournemouth, British Aerospace Systems at Salisbury Aerodrome in Lancashire, L3 Harris Factory in Brighton, East Sussex, and the British Aerospace Systems Govan site in Glasgow. L3 Harris Systems are integral to several US combat aircraft, including the F-22, the FA-18, and the F-35. It also manufactures bomb-release mechanisms for the F-35 combat aircraft and Reaper drone, both of which are deployed by Israel in Gaza. A trade unionist from the Group of Workers for a Free Palestine, which helped organize Thursday's action, said it was a necessary step to support the Palestinians trapped in the Gaza Strip. A trade union worker said, "The fighter jets these factories help to produce are being used to imprison the people of Gaza in a death trap. They're ordered to evacuate when they have nowhere safe to go, while our government still refuses to back a ceasefire." Workers all over Britain are rising up for Palestine, saying, "We will not allow arms used in a genocide to be supplied in our name and funded by our taxes." The F-35 is built by Lockheed Martin in the United States with the help of international partners, including British factories, which supply the components. Earlier this year, Israel placed an additional order of 25 F-35 aircraft in a deal worth $3 billion. With that order, Israel will be in possession of 75 F-35 warplanes. Workers in other parts of Europe, including the Netherlands, France and Germany, held similar demonstrations. Earlier this week, Dutch lawyers petitioned the court to demand the Netherlands government stop exporting F-35 components that could be used by the Israeli army. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. Amnesty International has conducted an investigation that showed a US-made weapons guidance system was used in two Israeli airstrikes in Gaza in October that massacred 43 people. According to a report released by the Human Rights Organization on Tuesday, 5th of December, fragments of the US-made Joint Direct Attack Munitions, or JDAM, guidance systems were found in the rubble of destroyed homes in the neighborhood of Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. Amnesty International said 19 children, 14 women and 10 men were martyred in that airstrike. Amnesty International said the JDAM, or the Joint Direct Attack Munitions, is a guided air-to-surface weapon that uses either the 2,000-pound BLU-109 MK-84, the 1,000-pound BLU-110 MK-83, or the 500-pound BLU-111 MK-82 warhead as the payload. JDAM enables employment of accurate air-to-surface weapons against high-priority fixed and reloadable targets from fighter jets and bomber aircraft. The human rights organization Amnesty International said it did not find any indication that there were any military objectives at the site of the airstrikes or that the individuals living in the homes were legitimate military targets. The report said the organization found that these airstrikes were either direct attacks on civilians or civilian objects or indiscriminate attacks, adding, based upon the heavy damage to the target and surrounding buildings, the bomb that struck the Al-Najjar residence probably weighed 2,000 pounds or above 900 kilograms, while the weapon that hit the Abu Mualek home is likely to have weighed at least 1,000 pounds or 450 kilograms. Agnes Callamard, Amnesty International Secretary General, said the fact that US-made munitions are being used by Israeli military in unlawful attacks with deadly consequences for civilians should be an urgent wake-up call to the Biden administration. The US-made weapons facilitated the mass killing of extended Palestinian families. Israel has been one of the world's largest recipients of U.S. military technology. The United States has long been giving Israel advanced weaponry such as the F-35 and missile defense systems, in addition to a wide range of sophisticated weaponry. On 6th of December, Israel said it received the 200th cargo plane carrying military equipment from the United States. In a report on X, formerly known as Twitter, Israel said over 10,000 tons of military equipment have been delivered by the United States to Israel since early October. Israel's great benefactor, the United States, has been providing the Israeli regime with virtually $3.1 billion worth of military assistance. The English website of Al Mayadeen Television Network has also covered this story and tells us more. Islamic Human Rights Commission has launched a massive campaign seeking a boycott of those governments and companies that support the ongoing Israeli genocidal war on Gaza. In a statement released on Tuesday, 5th of December, the Islamic Human Rights Commission, based in London, England, said Israel has now been committing genocide openly in front of the world's eyes. It further said Britain and other Western governments were complicit in the ongoing genocide by the Israeli regime against Palestinians of Gaza. The Islamic Human Rights Commission added, "Our governments are refusing to support a ceasefire to end the genocide. Instead, they are cheerleading the slaughter, providing arms and political cover so that Israel can continue exterminating Palestinians with impunity." The Islamic Human Rights Commission, based in London, said, "We must act now to do whatever we can to oppose this genocide. One of the easiest things to do is to boycott those that support genocide." The Islamic Human Rights Commission added, "There are many companies that support Israel and deserve to be boycotted, but this list of companies we have researched below is particularly despicable in that they have ramped up their support for Israel, often specifically for the military, whilst it commits genocide in front of our own eyes. In recent days, thousands of people have taken to the streets of London, England, calling for an immediate end to Israel's atrocities in the Gaza Strip. Among the general Western public, opinion polls show most Americans and Europeans want an end to Israel's war in Gaza. However, senior officials in Washington and other Western capitals have said they wouldn't be drawing any red lines for Israel, which has massacred thousands of Palestinian civilians already.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him,
why does he still pray 5 times a day? When so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Shasha with our guest speaker as always. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to Khums based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei for quite a while now, and let's continue our questions along the same line, Sheikh Javid. A loan was acquired for performing Hajj Tamattu. The question is, should its khums be paid before using the balance for Hajj? In other words, let me put it another way. Some people get some loans, take some loans for performing Hajj. Is this money, subject to khums too?
Well, first of all, I would like to say that you cannot perform Hajj al-Tamattu with borrowed money.
Mm-hmm.
Because you are a debtor in this case.
Yes.
Someone who is indebted to a bank, to an institution, to an individual, cannot perform Hajj wajib or obligatory Hajj, Hajj tamattu as you mentioned, and therefore, you know, he has to, first of all, he has to get rid of the borrowed money, he has to pay off the borrowed money, and then if he has an extra amount of money, then he of course can perform Hajj tamattu, and then everything related to Hajj tamattu. Hajj tamattu is the obligatory Hajj, for which one has to be financially capable. If you don't have the means, the money or the asset to travel to, for example, to Mecca, and you borrow money for that purpose, you are not, Hajj is not wajib on you. Now, in the event, let's say, in the event that you borrowed money, according to all religious scholars, there is no khums paid on borrowed money. Khums is not payable on loan. That's the point.
I see. Okay. I have paid an amount of money to a housing foundation over a period of 5 years for the purpose of purchasing a piece of land to build a house for myself. However, till now, no step has been taken to deliver the land. And so I decided to withdraw my money from the foundation.
Okay? Yes.
Well, I obtained a part of that money on loan. Another part came from the sale of the house carpet, and the rest from the salary of my wife, who is a teacher. Would you please answer these two questions that I have? First, if I get the money back and spend it exclusively for buying land or a house, would it be subject to khums? And the second question that I have, Sheikh Shawid, is that how much khums should be paid?
Because you mentioned in your question that, of course, you got the money, or maybe you obtained a part of that money on loan and another part from the sale of, you know, a house carpet, or maybe a portion of that money you got it from your wife. So that was not basically it wasn't your money that you paid towards buying a piece of land. So once you get it back, it is khums is not payable on that money, because you gained it, you received it either as a gift from your wife, or it's a borrowed money. So khums is not payable on borrowed money, nor is it payable on a gift received from someone. So if, for example, let's say you have paid, you have received that amount of money, and you think it is okay, it's my money, I want to use it, I want to buy it, use that money to buy a piece of land. Again, it's not necessary to pay khums on that money, because the piece of land that you want to buy and build a house in the future, according to many scholars, as far as I know, khums is not payable on that money.
Even if the money is yours.
Even if the money is yours, because you need to buy, you buy, you use that money to, let's say, to buy a piece of land.
Yes.
And then after sometimes you buy some bricks, some building materials to construct a house.
Yes.
And then after another year you save some money to build the building. Okay? So khums is not paid on that money which is saved up for buying a piece of land, for building a house which you essentially and very much urgently need.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Shawid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue your program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad Hossein. This program, and share with our guest speaker, we're still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws about khums based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Tawid, some years ago I acquired a bank loan and deposited it in my account for 1 year. I could not make use of the loan so far, but I had to pay its monthly installments. Is this loan subject to khums?
Now, either you have paid the installments or you have not paid it. Maybe if you have paid the installments, the money, the principal amount is still with you. Now, khums should be paid against that amount of money whose installments have been paid by you. Because the amount, you have not spent it, it's still there. So the installments have also been paid. And there is also some amount of money left in your account whose installments you have not paid yet. You are going to pay it in the future. So khums is not payable on that amount of money whose installments you have not paid or you have failed to pay it thus far.
Mm-hmm.
But that amount of money which is there in your account and whose installments you have paid, of course, you are not liable for the khums.
I see. There is another question, Sheikh Shobit. I have an outstanding debt on the house, and I will remain indebted for 12 years. Please enlighten us in regard to my liability to khums. In other words, is this debt to be subtracted from the gain of the year?
Well, according to His Eminence Ayatollah Khamenei, he allows such people who actually have outstanding debt to pay the installments of a loan which was spent last year for constructing a house and similar things, which are, of course, very basic needs. From their gains during the khums year, of course, during this year's khums, he allows such people, okay? So, and therefore, these people are not supposed to pay khums for the money which they earn this year, but of course, they spend it. They spent to pay off the loan for constructing and building a house, which they purchased last year.
Mm-hmm. And this debt should be subtracted from the gain of the year?
Of course.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Tawid, for your nice answers to the comments, to the questions that I raised regarding khums based on fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Thank you, my dear listeners, for choosing our channel, IRIB English Radio, for this program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio, okay? And keep us in your du'as. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم من جاء لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.